Hi, Marissa.
Hello, how are you?
I am good. How are you? I have already introduced you to my listeners in my introduction for this episode, but I just wanted to have a little bit of introduction from your end. So can you tell us who you are in your terms?
Yeah, thanks. So my name is Marissa, and I am a senior lecturer at the UQ Business School in Queensland, Australia. And my background is in psychology. My honours degree was in psychological science, and then I completed a PhD at UQ in the business school. I've stayed where I completed my PhD. It's a wonderful place to study and work. And my PhD was in really in organisational behaviour with a lot of organisational psychology involved. And one of my PhD advisors has actually studied social psychology. The other, another one was Gerald Greenberg. Some people might know Gerald Greenberg as the person who really came up with the concept of organizational justice. So I studied with people who had a very strong grounding in organizational psychology. And I also have a graduate certificate in higher education, and I work in a teaching-focused role. So most of the work that I do is teaching large undergraduate classes, and I teach organizational behavior. So I teach about leadership, emotions, stress, and burnout. And I also teach business ethics. And the rest of my time I spend in service and also doing research. So yeah, I really enjoy my work a lot.
Yeah, so you are like a very, lot of fields together, but you enjoy it a lot, I guess. That's really great, Marissa. So this episode is about grief. I wanted to talk about grief to you, and this is something that we don't talk that much about, although it's an emotion that we all share. And I believe that, we as humans are very social animals, right? And we have this collective idea, although we are like bounded by boundaries. We're like just separated by boundaries right now. I'm in India, you're in Queensland, but the emotion of happiness that we share is the same. But when it comes to grief, there is this idea that, people don't share it that much. So I just wanted to know your perspective on it. How do you take on to grief in general, and why is expressing grief important?
I agree. I think that as a culture, we don't often talk about death. We shy away from talking about death. We don't really acknowledge its occurrence very often in our culture. It's such a painful and confronting issue for so many people. Lots of people are afraid of death and the dying process in particular. People tend to be either afraid of dying or death itself. And so, yeah, it's certainly something that we don't talk about. And yeah, really, really difficult for people. And I guess it's one of those things people as individuals, as society, we try and live in the moment. We don't want to think about painful topics that make us feel uncomfortable. You don't want to think about what might happen to us in future or what might happen to our loved ones. So I think that death is largely hidden. But I think that, as a culture, I think we're getting better at talking about grief. I've certainly found some really helpful resources in my own journey. And it's a really challenging topic, but it's something that, we all have to deal with at some point, whether it's grief over the loss of a relationship, grief over, I mean, grief is about loss, so it can be about so many different aspects of our lives. I think that, losing a pet, for example, if you've ever loved an animal, you'll know how incredibly heart-wrenching and excruciating that loss can be. And yeah, I think that it's something that I think is really difficult to talk about and something that's difficult to confront, but I think we are getting better at it, and the more we discuss it, the more hopefully people will open up.
So you believe that, open discussions about grief is important. The way that we talk about happiness being as a collective emotion, we need to foster the understanding that grief is true, and that it might help us. Is that what you're like getting at?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think it's also important to recognize that some people may not be ready to talk about their experiences, and people, you know, should only really talk about things if they feel comfortable doing so. But I do think that, you know, all of the research tells us, and this is research in social psychology and clinical psychology, you know, we are social beings. We are kind of from an evolutionary perspective, we are designed to connect with other people. And I think that trying to go through a grief process alone, grieving alone, not opening up about it, not reaching out and connecting with other people who can share that experience, it often makes it harder.
Yeah.
And obviously it's a choice how people deal with grief. Not everyone feels like they're able to talk about it, but certainly from my experience, there are healthy ways of coping with grief and there are also relatively unhealthy ways. And I've tried both in my experience. And I remember a couple of years ago when one of my dogs died, and I'm a big dog lover. Dogs, I think, are just put on this earth, you know, to remind us that.
Me too.
You know, I've got this little badge and it says, you know, be the person your dog thinks you are.
Aww.
And they are just, you know, I think they're angels, you know, in animal form. And I love cats as well, but I have to say dogs are pretty special. And I remember when we lost our dog. We'd had him since he was, you know, a couple of weeks old, and he died when he was 14. And rather than dealing with that grief, I thought, you know, I would just throw myself into work and I would work as hard as possible. And I was working, you know, 60, 70 hours a week. And I was, I burnt out really quickly. I was just overwhelmed, physically overwhelmed, emotionally overwhelmed. And I realized I was doing these things really to avoid dealing with those really painful emotions that come up when we're grieving someone or something. So I think that finding a way to deal with grief that helps you to really feel those emotions and helps you find a path forward is so important. And that may not mean talking to people. It might mean, you know, finding a way to connect with nature, or it might mean finding resources about grief and reading about grief. But as long as you're channeling those emotions and allowing yourself to feel them and deal with them, you know, I think that's a really healthy way of dealing with it.
Yeah, we tend to repress grief a lot. It's a very common thing that people do when somebody dies. They throw themselves at work, you know. Marissa, I'm sorry that you suffered a recent loss, and you know that you kept everyone updated with your grief journey, because I was your follower on Twitter and I was following your journey. I lost my grandmother in the same timeline that you lost your mom to cancer. And I want to tell you, no matter what, how many people listen to this episode, I don't care. I just want to put it on word here that I have immense respect for you to do that, because I myself could feel everything that you said. And I felt like, you know, maybe what I'm feeling right now, this woman is there across seven oceans and she's feeling the same. And it's beautiful that you put it out there and you talked about it, you know, in general. So I just I have immense respect for you. Thank you so much for doing that. Sorry, I'm just a little bit emotional because it was like a really like a hard time for me that time. And I just was following your mom's journey as well. And the responses that you got on Twitter also was so beautiful from everybody else. And I just wanted to talk to you that, you know, generally people don't put out there what they are going through, their loved ones are going through, especially battling through terminal illness is something that people don't want to talk about when their loved ones do so. So if you are comfortable, can you tell us how opening up about this grief, you know, before your mom passed away and, you know, after she did, how did that help you go through the tough times? I know the before part hurts even more to see your loved one go through that process. And yeah, it was hard for me as well. So yeah, how did you, you know, how did the portrayal of grief on social media help you a little bit to go through the tough times is my question. Yeah.
Yeah, thank you. And I'm so sorry for your loss as well. It's something I think that, you know, connects people no matter where we are in the world. Mm-hmm. We all feel those really difficult emotions. And yeah, I don't know. I guess I am fairly open on social media about things that I have experienced. And I think that what I found is that it is sharing those difficult times that does help people connect, and being vulnerable and allowing others to see what you're going through and really being honest with your journey. That's what people respond to. People respond to authenticity. People respond to times that they can relate to, and particularly recognizing emotions in other people that they've experienced themselves. So I have been fairly open about my struggles with burnout, my struggles with chronic illness. And I thought, you know, I'm going to be honest about what I'm going through while I'm grieving as well. And I guess on Twitter, I only really shared some of what I was going through. I was a little bit more open on my Facebook and my private Instagram, where I have very close friends, but certainly at Twitter, you know, sharing the fact that my mother was terminally ill, I had people reaching out to me who I'd never met, kind of just saying, I'm so sorry. I've been journey myself. I can relate to what you're saying. I had a lot of academics reach out to me and say, put your family first.
Right.
You will not regret any time that you spend with your family. Everything else can wait. And I think that this was something that I certainly took on board, and I recognized that I really wanted to spend time with my family during this really difficult experience. And I mean, I think it's also important to recognize that everyone's experience with grief is different. And my particular journey, my mother had multiple chronic health conditions for a long time. She developed Parkinson's disease. She also had a chronic liver condition that we knew would at some point, ultimately, she would most likely develop cancer. So we were kind of living with this uncertainty for a very long time. Whereas there are other people who, you know, they lose a parent or a child or a friend suddenly. And I think losing someone suddenly, as opposed to this very long period, I think on one hand, I could prepare myself in some ways for the loss. But, you know, I think losing someone suddenly, it's such a shock. And yeah, it's you know, it's a very different, you know, everyone's journey is different. And I only look back now and I think I had really been grieving my mother for a really long time, and there'd been this process of anticipatory grief for several years as her condition gradually deteriorated. And I knew about, you know, about probably around March, April last year that, you know, she was really on borrowed time. And that was when I actually was really struggling at work with my workload, and also the challenges of caring for her. My family and I were her sole carers. And it was around March, April last year that I thought, I'm really going to have to look at my work responsibilities and prioritize my family and prioritize my health. Because by that point, I was actually becoming really physically ill, because I was just, the stress was just enormous. So I stepped down from a number of work projects. I stepped down as co-editor of a journal, which I'd been really excited about that role. You know, I was really enjoying working with my colleague and with our editorial team. But, you know, at the end of the day, nothing is more important than your health and your relationships, especially your family. And I'm really glad that I made that choice, you know, about 18 months ago now, to put my health first and put my family first, because I was spending so much time at work and I kept thinking, I'm losing days that I could be spending with my mum.
Right.
And so I guess in some ways I was preparing for it for a long time. But then in January of this year, my mum's health deteriorated quite considerably, and she was diagnosed with cancer, and she chose not to have further treatment. And we knew that she would probably only survive about 4 or 5 months at the most. So in some ways it was fortuitous, because I was able to go to my supervisor and at work and say, my mum probably only has a couple of months left. I would like to work part-time because I know what it's like, academia. I've worked in this field for long enough, and I know that, you know, when we're in the teaching semester, you're just working incredibly long hours. And I said, you know, I am happy to work part-time. I don't mind having a pay cut for 6 months or 5 months if it means that I can spend time with my family. And I'm really glad that I did that, because grief it doesn't just happen when you lose someone. As I said, there's this process of anticipatory grief and not knowing when is my mum going to deteriorate. She was so frail with the Parkinson's disease. You know, we were always worried that she might fall or she might get injured, and she had to get up at night several times at night. And she already had actually a few episodes when she'd fallen and she ended up in hospital. And the stress, not even the grief, but just the stress of living with a very frail elderly parent and having your other parent who's the full-time caretaker, and we have no other family, my sister and I and my parents, we have no other family here in Queensland who could help. So I was constantly living with intense anxiety, thinking, what if something happens to my dad and my sister and I will be the sole caretakers? That was incredibly stressful. So there were just so many emotions over the last 3 or 4 years. So what I found was that when my mother's health really deteriorated, I started teaching. We start the teaching semester in March here in Australia, and within about 3 or 4 weeks, I could see that her health she was going downhill really quickly.
Mm.
And I said to my colleagues, I need to take leave. I probably won't be back for 3 or 4 weeks. And they said, that's fine. I really want to say I'm so lucky to have incredible colleagues who stepped in and were able to cover my classes. And I know that we, you know, and I'm very open about the working conditions in academia and the long hours and the burnout and the pressure and so forth. But I have to say that the flexibility that was offered to me in my role and the support that I received from my supervisor to my immediate colleagues who said, I'll step in and teach for you, that made the grieving process so much easier. So I was very lucky to have that support from work. I was very lucky to be able to work part-time. And also, I think going back to the start of the question, you know, the support that I had, you know, on social media, people reaching out, people saying, if you ever want to talk, people giving me tips about how to navigate even just the administrative processes of seeking, going into a part-time role, all of that was so important. But the overriding message from academics was, put your family first. Work can wait. You will not regret spending time with your family. And you know, I was able really to have about a week with my mother before she developed with the liver cancer. You become quite confused, and she was on really high doses of pain medication. But there was about a week where we were able to watch movies together and have really important conversations and eat ice cream together and you know, ask really important questions. Like I asked her, when did you go through menopause? I didn't know that. You know, I'm going to be 50 in a few years. I wanted to know. It's important to know when your mom goes through menopause. You know, just think that, you know, and asking her things like, what are your favorite memories of growing up? And she said, when you've got little toddlers and they come and they put their arms around you and give you a big hug. That was, you know, some of her favorite memories. And you know, just being able to share that. And I just felt so privileged that I was able to literally just go on leave straight away and just, you know, spend a week with her. And then, you know, over time, as some people might be able to relate to, she was on really high doses of painkillers. And so she wasn't conscious for much of that last week, but we were still sitting with her and holding her hand and playing her favorite songs. And I have to say, you know, we were also immensely lucky to have full-time caretakers. We found a wonderful home care agency and we had nurses there around the clock who were able to bathe her, who were able to toilet her. And you know, they, you know, there are certain ways of turning patients so they don't develop bed sores. We yeah. didn't know how to do that, but we had nurses who could do that. So we were incredibly lucky to be able to do that. So I think, you know, it was incredibly difficult, but there were certainly some things that made it, you know, it made it a lot easier as well.
Right. Yeah. I mean, the journey that you portrayed on Twitter was amazing, Marissa, let me tell you, because you told us about your mom. I think a lot of your followers got attached to knowing what's going to happen next, you know, and we were praying for her and, you know, for her recovery as well. But then you told she's like terminally ill and then we just wanted her to be at peace. I remember that very nicely because same went for my grandmother. She was diagnosed with liver cancer. And for that time I was doing my thesis. So I had to like go back and forth. I was doing my master's thesis, so I had to go back and forth from my college. My college is like 2 to 3 hours from here. So I was doing back and forth and was leaving hostel at weird times and coming back home, holding her hand, listening to old music with her. And I think the last memories of me with her are now happy because, you know, I got to know how to deal with grief at that point. And I got to accept that maybe she'll be at peace more, like the cancer just leaves you immensely, you know. Like she was on medications the whole time. She didn't know who she was at the end of her days. So yeah, it was whatever you said, it resonated with me right now. So thank you for, you know, talking about it right now. It really, really means a lot. My next question, Marissa, is, you know, like you've been very open about mental health, of course, like we know that you're very famous on Twitter and like a lot of people know you in India as well. So the idea of publish or perish, I'm sure that you know that, you know, in academia that it exists and you are defined by the number of papers that you put onto journals, basically. And for that, you have to work constant hours in academia. So how would you seek this ideology that it impacts mental health? Does it impact it negatively or positively? What's your take on it?
My take on it is that it's an awful ideology. I wrote a paper several years ago about dealing with failure in mm-hmm. academia, and I still get people reaching out to me and saying how much they found it helpful. And I can provide you with the citation if you're interested in
yeah,
seeing
yeah.
that. But yeah, I remember, I don't know if the line actually ended up in the final paper or not, but you know, I remember thinking, publish or perish. Perish means to die, to disappear. And what an awful thing to be saying to people and to have this idea that if you don't publish in top journals, you know, that defines who you are and it defines your career. I just think that, unfortunately, I think that because academia is so competitive, and we're in a situation now where there are far too many PhD students graduating than there are jobs available.
Yeah.
Universities have to kind of discriminate between candidates. And for most top research institutions, they do that by looking at your publication record And I can say right now that if I were to apply for jobs, I would be struggling on the job market. If I graduated with, I don't think I even had, I had a book. I had several book chapters and I had multiple conference papers. I was lucky enough to go to many, many conferences throughout my PhD. But I didn't have a journal publication. I did not have a single journal article when I completed my PhD. And that was largely because I spent a lot of time going to conferences and not actually publishing in journals as I was supposed to. But I never really wanted a research career. I always wanted to teach. Mm. And even now my publication record is largely it's largely workshops and conference papers and other outlets. It's not necessarily journals.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that I think that academia the culture makes us believe that, you know, we take on our publications as though they're a part of ourselves and they're part of our identity and they define who we are. Mm-hmm. And I think it's so important to have an identity outside of academia.
Right.
And this idea of publish or perish, I think it can have a really negative impact on mental health. I don't know if it affects everyone in a negative way, but I know just from anecdotal evidence and I know from journal articles, I think there was actually a really interesting paper about publish or perish and how it affects academics in business schools. We know that, you know, when you're starting out as an early career scholar, people are under enormous pressure and they're constantly thinking, if I don't publish, I'll perish. I won't be employable. I won't be on I won't have a tenure track position. I won't get tenure. And I don't know what the answer is, because right now in academia, for most roles, you do need those really high numbers of publications. But I think it's important to recognize that more and more people are going into industry where don't have that same expectation. And I think that one way that you can kind of deal with this is by thinking, you know, really thinking about, do I want an academic career? And if you would rather go into industry, that's okay. Not everyone has to work in academia. Industry is a wonderful career path for people.
Right.
And, you know, nothing is worth sacrificing your mental health and your physical health.
Yeah, that's, I agree with whatever you said. Generally, people have this idea that, you know, we need to publish, otherwise, you know, we won't get into positions. And right now, Marissa, the job market, I don't know about that, but my friends and I were applying to PhD programs, and the basic minimum criteria that they had was we need to have at least one publication, and we are in a master's. How are we supposed to have a publication by now? By that, I have to start working when I was in second year of my undergrad program. And that is just crazy. I cannot put in so much effort with the coursework in academia that is also very immense that we have in a BSMS degree. So yeah, the job market is going crazy right now. I completely understand. That's why people are shifting to industry a little bit more now. It is better pay and flexible hours and everything. But I still believe, you know, that the idea of academia still holds true. But the idea of publish and perish should just go away, is what I would. Yeah, because this is a very bad thing to tell people. And top universities like John Hopkins and Harvard have the basic minimum criteria to have at least one publication, which was just... You know, we were just like, how can we have a publication? We barely wrote our thesis right now of master's. So that is just, it was very crazy. So Marissa, do you have any concluding remarks? And tell us a little bit about your book of Handbook of Mental Health, because it will be out, I think, soon, if I'm not sure.
Probably the middle of next year, we're hoping it will finally, it will be published. Okay. So thanks. I am incredibly lucky to be co-editing the Handbook of Academic Mental Health, and that's with my wonderful co-editors, Angela Martin from the University of Tasmania, and Neil Ashkenazi, who was my PhD advisor. And Neil and I have continued to work together now for, we've been publishing for nearly 20 years. He's just wonderful, so supportive. I just struck gold when I had him as a supervisor on my PhD. He's just wonderful, and he's a world expert in emotions, and also, you know, really passionate about exploring areas of study that are related to emotions. And obviously mental health, stress and burnout are also very much in Neil's research domain. So we are publishing the handbook, and we have, honestly, off the top of my head, I don't know how many chapters we will finally have, but it will be probably between 25 and 30 chapters in the volume. Mm-hmm. We have authors from all around the world, and we're addressing a whole range of issues that are relevant to academic mental health. We're talking about teaching evaluations, about the doctoral student journey, about job insecurity in academia, and it's a whole range of different topics. And we've been editing these chapters with our wonderful authors for about 18 months ago now. We kind of contacted the publisher with the idea, and we've been just working with also with our wonderful editorial assistant, I should also say, Lauren Cox, bringing it together. And it's really designed to be a handbook that showcases the wide variety of research in the field of academic mental health. And we've got quite a few also lived experience pieces, and people talking about their time as a doctoral student or as an early career researcher and what that was like. And my colleague Zoe, most of you will know Zoe from Twitter, who does an enormous amount of work in the academic mental health space, and who's written her own book for PhD students. We've also written a chapter talking about how we are connected and what our journeys were like as PhD students and early career academics, and how we developed the Voices of Academia blog.
Yeah.
And how we connected and shared you know, that experience developing a blog together. And so it's designed to, as I said, showcase what's happening in academic mental health today. And it's so wonderful knowing that there are researchers from across the world who are so passionate about finding ways to improve academia. And I think that the book will really highlight the many problems that we face in academia today with, as I said, job insecurity, publish or perish, financial constraints, pressure on doctoral students, abuse and bullying and harassment. We hear many stories of that occurring, but I think it will also really, you know, highlight that people care about this issue, and that there are interventions and there are people out there who are trying really hard to improve academia for the better. Mm-hmm. So, the book will hopefully come out next year. It's been a really nice process.
I'm looking forward to it because it's been talked about everywhere on Twitter right now. So that's why I'm just like, I need to talk to Marissa about it. And maybe, you know, we can have another episode when your book comes out and we can talk more about the book. And I am really looking forward to the book. Let me just tell you that. Marissa, thank you so much for coming and speaking about grief. It's something that I wanted to talk to you about because of your Twitter thread, basically. But then I think a lot of people will relate to whatever you said. I don't care, like I said, how many people listen to this. I have immense respect for you, for what you did and what you are doing in academic circles, in mental health as well. And we respect you a lot, even here, community in India does. And thank you so much for coming. And thank you so much for sharing your insights on grief. This was amazing. A wonderful episode with you. I really am looking forward to whenever it will be published, and I'll be like, yes, I interviewed Marissa.
Oh, that's so kind of you. I guess just to add to what I said, I think it's important not to put too much pressure on yourself when you're going through the grieving process. Yeah. And I think that everyone grieves in different ways. Mm. For some people, they might want to continue working full time. Mm. You know, for me, I felt that going part-time at work was the best option for me, but for others, it might be, you know, staying in full-time work. Mm. I think also it's okay to cry. It's okay to go through those difficult emotions, but it's also okay, you know, to smile and to laugh. And, you know, I had friends who, you know, would take me out for ice cream and make sure that I wasn't just, you know, sitting with my mum all the time, and I was still able to spend time with people and connect with people. And so I think it's really important that there's to know that there's not just one way to grieve. You're still allowed to do those things that bring you enjoyment. It's, you don't have to be sad all the time. And I think grief comes with so many different emotions. It's such a journey. And I think you can feel sad for some of the things that happened, but you can also look back and also feel happy. And I think also relief. I think it's really important. This will kind of be my last concluding point, is really that it's okay to feel relief when somebody dies as well. It's not just about feeling sad. For me, I miss my mum a lot, but I'm also really relieved that she isn't suffering any longer. And I think you have to give yourself permission to feel all of the emotions.
Yeah. My God. Thank you, Marissa. I really needed to hear that again. Thank you so much for coming and talking and speaking about all these things. And I am looking forward to the episode whenever it gets published. So thank you for coming and talking. Yeah. Bye.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
One of my favorite lines, my dear listeners, read that, it can't all be sorrow, can it? I've always been alone, so I don't feel the lack. It's all I've ever known. I've never experienced loss because I have never had a loved one to lose. But what is grief if not love persevering? Thank you for tuning in, my dear listener, for giving me the opportunity to interact with my idols and learn about life as we navigate through it. And to Dr. Marissa, I cannot believe I had a conversation with you. Thank you so, so much for gracing me and all of us with your words and intellect. And I promise you, this is something that I will carry throughout my life. Grief is unexpressed love, so let it shine through you in the form of kindness. And remember, you are not alone in this. And as always, my dear listener, stay warm, stay safe, and I shall see you in the next episode. Bye. India is a land of diversity, a statement that we've been fed since our school. It is said that we were the most advanced when it came to science, and that before we let the US became the most advanced nation of the world, we held the best scientists of the globe. It's a political statement. My dear listeners, I generally refrain from making one since science knows no boundaries, and yet we somehow know how to politicize and capitalize it. A nation's scientific worth determines its progress, and still, the spread of misinformation uproars in a nation with scientific literacy. The question for the need of science communication in a developing nation is of paramount importance. It not only determines how much we can inform our public, but also how can we inform them. It's a small step that premier institutions like IISc's, ICER's, and NCBS has taken up, but we still have a lot, long, long way to go. Today, I have a remarkable guest with me who is making waves in India and is taking the story of Indian science communication to the West and beyond. His name, Siddharth Kankariya.